Brother Chairman. Well, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, we take up then again this morning the story of Jonathan. And you'll remember that we had left Jonathan on the occasion of our previous study, having entered into a covenant with David, a covenant of friendship, and that as this was typical of the disciples, we're reminded thereby that we as the disciples have also been invited into a covenant of friendship with the Beloved. And that the basis of our friendship with the Beloved is the same, and that is that we acknowledge His superior right to the throne. And that not only do we acknowledge His superior right to the throne, but that we should strip ourselves of all dignity and pride and that which belongeth to the flesh. And we should declare ourselves to be defenceless before Him and under His power. And on that basis we can enjoy the same friendship with our Lord as Jonathan and David enjoyed together in days of old. You'll remember that Jonathan had successfully reconciled the hostility between David and between his father in the 19th chapter as a result of the great tact and sensitivity he had shown, so that all things were restored to a state of peace and of happiness. And therefore, the words of the 1st of Samuel and chapter 20, verse 1, are a rude awakening again, aren't they, as far as the story was concerned in the life of Jonathan. Because we're told here that David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is mine iniquity and what is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life?" You know, when you read verse 1, brothers and sisters, we're impressed with the fact that David is agitated in mind. Remember, it's all the way we read, isn't it? Good Bible study, good Bible reading. Now, read verse 1 again of chapter 20. Can you see David's agitation of mind here? "And David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin?'" You can see that this was really churning over David's mind. And so we have a triple statement of anguish here from David as he speaks to Jonathan. And you know the thing that really upset David? It wasn't so much that Saul was seeking to slay him, although no doubt that would be upsetting, but the real thing was that Saul had never charged David with any crime. David didn't know what he'd done. David didn't know why this was happening. "What have I done? What is mine iniquity? What is my sin?" That was what upset David. And if David was upset by that, when David said that to Jonathan his friend, Jonathan was equally upset, as the second verse shows us, when these words came forth from his friend. And so Jonathan replies, and he says, "God forbid, thou shalt not die. Behold, my father will do nothing either great or small, but that he will show it to me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." And so Jonathan now is surprised and distressed by the words that he hears from David. Because you see, he thought that he'd achieved a reconciliation. He had no idea that this particular problem was occurring. And David's state of agitation in the first verse is matched by Jonathan's anguish in the second verse as he reacts now to the distress of his friend. And you know, there are three denials that Jonathan gives in the second verse in response to David's cries, to David's triple cry in verse 1. So David says, "What have I done? What is mine iniquity? What is my sin?" And Jonathan replies, and here's the three denials from Jonathan. By the way, the phrase "God forbid" literally means "be it far from thee." And the three denials that Jonathan makes are, "Be it far from thee, thou shalt not die," and at the end of the verse, "it is not so." So you see, David's three statements of grief are matched now by Jonathan's own distress as he seeks to deny what is equal. Jonathan couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that Saul, his own father, would actually think of murdering David in cold blood. He knew that Saul had a brooding discontent, but he couldn't believe that his father would actually do it in cold blood. Now that tells us something, by the way. The reaction of Jonathan in the second verse tells us something. And that's this. That if Jonathan is genuine, and we believe of course that he was, then Jonathan cannot have been aware of the later events of the 1st of Samuel 19. If you come back to the 1st of Samuel 19, we're told in the 8th verse, after reconciliation had been effected, just a page back, in the 1st of Samuel 19 and verse 8, and there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter, and the evil spirit from Yahweh was upon Saul as he sat in his house with his javelin in his hand, and David played with his hand, and Saul sought to smite David to the wall even with the javelin. So first of all, chapter 19 tells us of the incident with the javelin. And then chapter 19 tells us of the incident when he sent spies to spy out the house of David to seek to slay David. And then chapter 19 tells us about David fleeing to Samuel in Ramah and of Saul sending messengers to try and take David there. Now, you see, Jonathan just couldn't have known that, could he? Because, you see, if Jonathan says in the 1st of Samuel 20 in verse 2, he says, my father will do nothing either great or small but that he will show it to me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so, says Jonathan. He obviously didn't know that those things had occurred. Now, there's only two reasons why Jonathan couldn't have known. Either he was away, and he may have been sent to some other part of the kingdom by Saul, his father, to get Jonathan out of the way while Saul was busy pursuing David. It could have been the case. Or that in some other way the matter was concealed by Saul from Jonathan. Jonathan really didn't know that those things had happened. And I think that of the two, well, it may have even been a combination, but certainly I think the matters were concealed from Jonathan. And the proof of that is what David says in verse 3, because he says, David said, thy father knows that I have found grace in thine eyes. And he said, quoting Saul, let not Jonathan know this. So that's why Jonathan didn't know. Because the matter had been concealed from him. And do you know what else verse 2 tells us? It tells us that Jonathan always thought the best of his father. He says, let it not be far from me. My father will do nothing, either great or small, but he will show it to me. And why should my father hide this? It isn't so. I can't believe it. I just don't believe it, says Jonathan. He always thought the best of his dad. We're going to see that coming out in this story a little bit later on this morning. And so David responds in verse 3. David swore moreover and said, thy father certainly knoweth that I have found grace on earth. David swore, says the record. And later in the verse we have the oath that he swore, because he says, as truly as Yahweh liveth, and as thy soul liveth, there is but a step between me and death. David swore with an oath. Now that made things very serious indeed. That was something that really made the matter absolutely serious as far as Jonathan. That David was prepared to swear to this situation with an oath in the name of God. Jonathan had to listen to that. And the danger was, you see what verse 3 says? What did David say? Thy father knows that I've found grace in thine eyes. And he said, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. So you see, what David was saying is that Saul did have some knowledge of the friendship that existed between these two men. And as a result of Saul's knowledge, certain matters had now been concealed from Jonathan. And I believe that that shattered Jonathan. I believe Jonathan would have been deeply upset to hear that from David. Because, you see, up to this point of time, it would appear that he had his father's full trust and confidence. Jonathan was very close to Saul, and Saul, for that matter, was very close to his son, Jonathan. And the record would seem to imply that up to this point of time, the fullest trust existed between father and son. And what Jonathan has been told now is his father is doing things behind his back which he didn't know about. And not only that he hasn't the trust of his father anymore, but that the reason why he's lost it is simply because he, Jonathan, had sought to be faithful and just in the truth. How would you feel when all you tried to do is what was right and the truth, and as a result of that, your trust has been betrayed by your own dad? Verse 4, well, here's Jonathan's reaction. Then said Jonathan unto David, Whatsoever thy soul desireth, I will even do it for thee. It says, then said David. When is then? And the answer is, after David had sworn with an oath, then, when Jonathan heard that, when he realised how serious David was, that he was prepared to swear to this matter on oath, then Jonathan said, whatsoever thy soul desires, I'll even do it. You see the simplicity of this statement. It tells us that Jonathan now had accepted the situation as being truthfully revealed by David. He was impressed with the certainty of David's conviction. And he simply said, look, if that's the case, whatever thy soul desires, I will even do it for thee. And isn't that the attitude of all disciples, all faithful disciples to their Lord? Isn't that what we say to Christ? Whatsoever thy soul desires, I will even do it for thee. That's the work of the disciples, isn't it? In their covenant of friendship with the Beloved. And what Jonathan realizes now is he sees his father in a new light, or begins to. It's the inevitable result of friendship with David. And we experience that same principle. The inevitable result of joining in friendship with Christ is that other friendships come under strain if they are based on a fleshly perspective. And so the Lord says in Matthew 10, he that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And Jonathan now was feeling that strain of the relationship with his father. He didn't find it easy. And so David says, verse 5, David said unto Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king at meat. But let me go that I may hide myself in the field unto the third day at even. Now the Septuagint translation translates verse 5 in a different way. In fact, a very different way, because the Septuagint translation says, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I shall not on any account sit down to eat. So the authorized version says that I really ought to sit down. The Septuagint says, I'm definitely not going to sit down. I have no intention of sitting down. Maybe, in fact, the balance lies between the two, that he was saying, well, I really ought to be there, but in fact I'm not going to be. And so David says, well, look, let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third day at even. Verse 6, if my father at all missed me, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me that he might run to Bethlehem his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. And if he say thus, it is well, thy servant shall have peace. But if he be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined of him. So you see, what David was proposing here, and by the way, I believe David did run to Bethlehem. I don't believe that David was proposing a lie here. I don't think David was saying, well, let's say this and this and this, and then we'll see what happens. If he said that he was going to go to Jerusalem to Bethlehem for a family sacrifice, then he would go. And 3 days was ample time to make the journey from the house of Saul down to Bethlehem and back again in time for the end of that 3-day period. I think we'll take that up on the record a little bit later on. I think he actually did go down. I don't think David was proposing to concoct a deceit here. But what they were proposing was this. You see, here was the problem. Because of Saul's deceit, because Saul now wasn't talking to Jonathan, because they couldn't trust, because Jonathan couldn't really approach his father openly and ask him what he felt, they had to, by some means, devise a plan by which the king would reveal his mind involuntarily. They had to get it so that somehow Saul would spontaneously reveal what he was really thinking. And not only that, but in the process of Saul really revealing his true mind, then Jonathan would witness at first hand the evidence of his father's reaction, and if Jonathan had any doubts as to what his father felt, then it would be clarified one way or the other by what his father did. David says, we've got to do something that will make your father show his hand, and then you'll know and I will know. But you can't go and ask him outright, because he doesn't trust you anymore. He's hiding things from you. And so verse 8 says, therefore, says David, thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of Yahweh with thee. Notwithstanding, if there be in me iniquity, slay me thyself, for why shouldest thou bring me to thy son? You know, the Jerusalem Bible has a good translation of the first part of the 8th verse. It says, do this favour for your servant, since you have united yourself with him by a pact in Yahweh's name. And you see, what the 8th verse is telling us is that the friendship of these two was not based upon mere social enjoyment, nor was it based purely on emotional ties. It was a friendship that was based upon a mutual reverence and respect for Yahweh and for the things of his truth. You have united yourself with thy servant by a pact in Yahweh's name. There was the basis of the friendship between these two. And then David says at the end of the verse, but he says, if there be in me any iniquity, he says, I don't know what I've done, but if there is something, if it's me, perhaps it is something I've done, perhaps it's my fault, says David, and if it is my fault, then you slay me, Jonathan, you, my friend, rather than being taken to your father. And Jonathan says, verse 9, far be it from thee, for if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon thee, then would not I tell thee. You see where it says, far be it from thee, that's the same phrase in the Hebrew translated God forbid in verse 2. So there it is, it's the same phrase. Far be it from thee, says Jonathan. And you notice how Jonathan is struggling in the 9th verse here to come to grips with his father's attitude. He's not prepared to outrightly condemn his father. Do you see that? He says, if I knew certainly, if I could only know certainly that evil were determined, but I'm not sure, says Jonathan. He wasn't prepared, you see, to criticize his father bluntly and make an outright condemnation of him. That was the spirit of Jonathan towards his end. That Jonathan knew his father. Didn't Jonathan know his father? He knew his father's weaknesses, but he wasn't prepared to outrightly say to David, you're quite right, my father's a rotter. Jonathan would never ever say that. Verse 10. Then said David to Jonathan, who shall tell me, or what if thy father answer thee roughly? You know, when you read this story, and you read the words of David, we're given the impression that here is a young man going to pieces. That's the story of David in this chapter. And here it is finally in verse 10. Well, who's going to tell me, you know, after this has all been sorted out and you've found out what your father thinks, who will tell me? And what if your father answer me roughly? David is going to pieces in this story. He may have been a valiant man in the Valley of Elah, but he doesn't know how to stand in the royal palace. He's a young man. He's untested as yet in the various trials of life. He knows how to slay a giant, but he doesn't know how to cope with envy. He's not mature, David. David's the young man in this story. It's Jonathan who's the mature character, and it's Jonathan who therefore has to take control of the situation to sort the whole problem out, to comfort David, because David is the one who's going to pieces, not Jonathan. So look what Jonathan says, verse 11. Jonathan said unto David, come and let us go into the field. And they went out, both of them, in the field. You can just see that, can't you? David says, well, what are we going to do? How will we communicate? What if your father answers roughly? Jonathan says, look, come. Come into the field, we'll have a chat about it. Come on. You can just see Jonathan, can't you? Just quietly settling things there. You know, there were two reasons why I believe they went into the field. The first reason was because royal walls have ears. And Jonathan wanted to ensure that this conversation that he had with David, that nobody heard, was private between these two friends. And the second reason was, I think, that what Jonathan was saying was, look, let's go and find a quiet spot where we can discuss how best to handle the problem so that Yahweh might be honored, so that your life might be preserved, and so that I don't need to have to betray my father. We want the truth to be advanced in the best possible way. Let's find a quiet place where we can sit down and work this out in the best interests of the truth. That should always be our spirit, shouldn't it? What will be best for the truth? You know, it's interesting, actually. Jonathan said to David, come and let us go out into the field. And they went out, both of them, into the field. Is that a Bible echo? This is Rotherham's translation from a certain chapter in Genesis. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, saying, "Let us go into the field." And it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. And Yahweh said to Cain, "Where is Abel, thy brother?" And he said, "I know not. Am I my brother's keeper?" And Jonathan said to David, "Let's go into the field." And it's the very terms of Genesis 4. But Jonathan was the very reverse of Cain. He intended to act as his brother's keeper, to ensure that David's blood would not be shed. He doesn't have the jealous spirit of Cain. An interesting allusion, isn't it? Let us go into the field. He went out into the field to preserve David's life, to ensure that David would survive to inherit the throne. And in verse 12 we're told, this is what was said when they went into the field. "And Jonathan said unto David, O Yahweh Elohim of Israel." That was a funny thing to say to David, wasn't it? And Jonathan said to David, "O Yahweh." The Jerusalem Bible and the Revised Version translate the phrase as follows: "Yahweh Elohim of Israel be witness." So here they are in the field. And Jonathan looks at David, and the first thing he says is, "David, Yahweh Elohim of Israel be witness of what we're about to talk about." So it's Jonathan who brings God into the matter. You know, brothers and sisters, all good things in the truth invoke Yahweh's hand in the matter. All good plans that we ever make will always seek for Yahweh Elohim of Israel, witness and bless. You can't make good plans without the involvement of the Father. And Jonathan knew that. It's Jonathan that brings God into the conversation, not David. And he says, "When I've sounded my father, when I've sounded him about tomorrow any time or the third day, and behold, if there be good toward David, and I then send not unto thee and show it thee, Yahweh do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it please my father to do thee evil, then I will show it thee and send thee away, that thou mayest go in peace, and Yahweh be with thee as he hath been with my father." And so he would send David away, says Jonathan. He would send David away to preserve his life so that David might yet inherit the throne that Jonathan knew belonged to him. And I think that, you see, Jonathan felt that he could do this without compromising his loyalty to his father. That he could be loyal to Saul and yet at the same time send David away so that his friend's life would be preserved. See, this was the conflict that Jonathan had, wasn't it? All the time. All the time. How do I help David? How do I show loyalty to my father? Oh, it's a terrible thing that Jonathan had to work out all the time. And he said, "I believe that we can do this." He says, I'll send you away that you can go and see, but I'll still be honourable to my father. He says in verse 12, "When I've sounded my father." Proverbs 20 in verse 5 says, "Counsel in the heart of a man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out." And that's what Jonathan was going to do, wasn't it? He was going to plumb the depth of his father's mind. It was like very deep water, Saul's thinking. But a man of understanding would, "When I've sounded my father," he says, "I'll see what the matter is." Now, I'll tell you what, brothers and sisters, there's a marvellous, marvellous spirit here that's shown by Jonathan in this record. It all revolves around a particular word. Here it is. Here's David's attitude to Saul. We're based on a key word. Now look at David in these verses that we've looked at so far. Here's David's attitude. First of Samuel chapter 20 and verse 1. David says, "What is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life?" Verse 3. Thy father saith, let not Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. He's a deceitful man. Verses 6 and 7. If thy father be very wroth, then be sure that evil is determined by him. Verse 8. Slay me thyself, for why shouldest thou bring me to thy father, he says. Verse 10. Who shall tell me, or what if thy father answer me roughly? What did David think of Saul? Wasn't really very positive, was he? And I suppose we can't blame him. Now, do you want to see Jonathan's attitude in those verses? The same man. Here's Jonathan. Verse 2. Why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so, here's Jonathan. You see the spirit he had of honouring his father? Verse 9. For if I knew certainly that evil were determined by my father to come upon me, he wasn't prepared to criticize his father. Verse 12. When I have sounded my father, and behold, if there be good toward David, you see, there could have been good or evil. Which one does Jonathan assume first? If there be good. He assumes that first. Verse 13. But if it please my father to do the evil, reluctantly, oh, very reluctantly, does Jonathan even acknowledge that that might be a possibility. And finally, verse 13, Yahweh be with thee, as he has been with my father. You know, that is, isn't it, absolutely the spirit of honour. Jonathan was a man who respected his father. Honour thy father and thy mother. And you know that even in the pledge that Jonathan makes to David, verses 12 and 13, of what he would do for his friends, that's the two verses when he tells David what he would do, there is not one ungracious word that comes out of Jonathan's lips about his own dad. Never ever. He never ever criticized, Saul in front of David. Whatever he might have thought, deep in his own heart. Now there's the principle of respect, isn't it? Actually, I prefer the word honour to respect. Respect is a slightly more technical sounding term. You know, you ought to have respect. Oh, well, I suppose I ought to respect them. And you could perhaps manifest respect with a grudging spirit, couldn't you? But you can't do that with honour. If you honour somebody, you really have to do it. And Jonathan showed the way in terms of his attitude to his father, even though Saul was in fact an evil man. You know what, I think David was impressed with that. You come to the 24th chapter, it's only a short while later on in the story. Come to the 24th chapter, look at the spirit of David later on. Where did he get this spirit from? 1 Samuel 24, this is only a short time later on, as he's fleeing from Saul. Remember the story of what happened in the cave, verse 3. He came to the sheepcote by the way, where was a cave, and Saul went in to cover his feet, and David and his men remained in the sides of the cave. And the men of David said unto him, Behold, the day which Yahweh said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And it came to pass afterwards that David's heart smote him, because he cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, Yahweh forbid that I should do this thing unto my master Yahweh's anointed, to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing as the anointed of Yahweh. So David stayed his servants with these words, and suffered them not to rise against Saul. And when Saul came, when Saul spoke to David, you see what David said to him in verse 11? He called him my father. Where did David get that spirit from? Of respect for Saul, of respect for authority, of respect for the kingship, of respect for Yahweh's anointed. Well, I'm sure he had it himself, but he also saw it in Jonathan. Jonathan was the role model that David copied. He was impressed with that spirit from this man who would not criticize his own father. Now, I'll tell you what, brothers and sisters, and perhaps particularly young people, that's the spirit that is largely missing in today's society. The principle of respect or of godly honour has all but disappeared in life. But it's still a Bible principle. And it all starts with respect for God. Malachi chapter 1 verse 6, a son honours his father and a servant his master. If I then be a father, where is mine honour, says God in Malachi 1 verse 6. It all starts with respect for God, doesn't it? That's the beginning of the story. And out of our respect for the Father, our reverence for the Father, our honour for the Father, brings an attitude that should invade and pervade every part of our life. Within the family, honour thy father and mother. Within the ecclesia, let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honour. In the workplace, count your masters worthy of all honour. Under the state, render to whom due, tribute to whom tribute, and honour to whom honour. It's a divine principle. And we live in an age where that principle is ridiculed. But wise young people will learn that it is a godly principle all the same. And Jonathan showed that principle to his father. Marvellous, marvellous truth. And if we had ecclesias where that principle was at work within our families, within our marriages, within our workplaces, then how good and how pleasant a thing it would be. You see what Jonathan says, coming back to the 20th chapter, you see this note of tragedy that begins to enter into the narrative now as Jonathan continues his conversation with David. You notice the words at the end of verse 13. He says, and Yahweh be with thee, as he hath been with my father. You know, the Jerusalem Bible makes that just a little bit more clear. He says, the Jerusalem Bible says, and Yahweh be with thee, as he used to be with my father. You know what that tells us? As he used to be with my father. Jonathan knows that Saul is his. He knows that. He knows that Yahweh has departed from his father. As he used to be with my father. You know, what a lovely cry from a son, lamenting his father. And as a result of that, you see what Jonathan says in the 14th verse. He says, and thou shalt not only while yet I live show me the kindness of Yahweh, that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. You know, the Septuagint translates those verses as follows. And I think it gets perhaps a better sense of the text. Verse 14. And if indeed I continue to live, then thou shalt deal mercifully with me. And if I indeed die, thou shalt not withdraw thy mercy from my house forever. I'll say that again. And if indeed I continue to live, then thou shalt deal mercifully with me. And if I indeed die, thou shalt not withdraw thy mercy from my house forever. So Jonathan pleads David's mercy after he becomes king. And you see, what Jonathan's really saying here, there's almost a sense of foreboding, isn't there? In this, and if, he says, if I die, don't withdraw your kindness from my house. Why would Jonathan say that? Unless he had some premonition that maybe death would take him early. Some sense of impending disaster that hung over him because of his association with the house of his father. So if I die, if I live, keep thy loving kindness with me. And if I die, withdraw not thy mercy from my house forever. And so Jonathan pleads for the kessed mercy of David when he becomes king. You know what David has pleaded in verse 8 for as far as Jonathan? He says, therefore thou shalt deal kindly, that's the same word, kessed, loving kindness or mercy. Thou shalt show loving kindness to thy servant. So David says, please show me your chesed mercy to thy servant. Jonathan says, no, you show chesed mercy to me when you become king. These two men highly esteemed each other. One says, show me your chesed even to thy servant. Jonathan says, no, you show me your chesed when you become king. They highly esteemed each other, these two, didn't they? You know why Jonathan asked for that? Why that the kindness of David was not to be cut off from Jonathan's house forever? Because, of course, it was the practice of monarchs, wasn't it, when they ascended the throne, to simply exterminate all rival houses. And so Jonathan's prayer and Jonathan's entreaty at this stage was that David would not show that spirit of revenge whereby Jonathan's house would be exterminated. And in fact, I believe that what he's saying in the 15th verse is that David is seeking to buoy up, sorry, Jonathan is seeking to buoy up David's spirit by speaking with conviction about the time and about the certainty of David's future kingship. He says, look, when you're king, David, and you will be, you know, don't withdraw your kindness from my house. When you're king, David. He's seeking to encourage David to look beyond the present and to say the day is coming when you will be king. I believe that, David, says Jonathan. Don't cut off thy cloak. You see what he says? Let's read verse 15 completely. Thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David, everyone from the face of the earth. That is, when he became king. You know, brothers and sisters, David never forgot that promise. If you come to the 2nd of Samuel in chapter 9, he never ever forgot that promise, that pledge that Jonathan thought of him as these two talked in the field. We're told in the 2nd of Samuel chapter 9 in verse 1, and David said, is there yet any that is left of the house of Saul that I may show him chesed, kindness, for Jonathan's sake? And there was of the house of Saul a servant whose name was Ziba, and when they had called him unto David, the king said unto him, art thou Ziba? And he said, thy servant is he. And the king said, is there not yet any of the house of Saul that I may show him the loving kindness of God unto him? It was the very term that Jonathan had asked him to show, loving kindness. And you see what Ziba said. Oh, imagine how this would have affected David. And Ziba said unto the king, Jonathan hath yet a son. And the king said, where is he? And of all the house of Saul, the only surviving member was Jonathan's own son. And David went out of his way to remember that promise that he'd made to Jonathan, that his kindness wouldn't. Remember what verse chapter 20 has said? It says, don't withdraw thy kindness, no, not when Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David, everyone from the face of the earth. You know why this is significant in the 2nd of Samuel 9? Because in the 2nd of Samuel 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, those five chapters are devoted to the time when Yahweh cut off all the enemies of David from the face of the earth. That's what those five chapters are about. And at the very time when God cut off all David's enemies, David remembered that promise, that he would not withdraw kindness from Jonathan's house. Never ever forgot that. Come back to the 1st of Samuel chapter 20. And so verse 16 says, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let Yahweh even require it at the hand of David's enemies. So Jonathan made a covenant. They've already made a covenant, surely. Didn't they make a covenant in chapter 18? Why make it again? Why make a covenant again for the second time if you've already done it? Well, I think there were a couple of reasons. The first thing is because, you see, when they made the covenant in chapter 18, it was being made in days of gladness. But what they're doing now is they are renewing their covenant, they are re-pledging their covenant love for each other in the midst of trial. That's something different, you see. To honour one's covenant of friendship in difficult times as opposed to the times of joy and happiness. And the second reason is because if you read verse 16 carefully, the covenant is being extended now. It's no longer just between Jonathan and David. It's now to be between the house of Jonathan and the house of David. It's being extended to their respective families. And notice again that it's Jonathan who's the prime mover in the matter. So Jonathan made a covenant, verse 16, and Jonathan caused David, verse 17. It's all of Jonathan again. And so the second covenant is made. The first one was in chapter 18, and here's the second one now in chapter 20. And so their covenant was re-pledged amidst trouble and sorrow that in fact threatened their friendship. Jonathan again acknowledged David's superior rights to the throne by pleading for covenant mercy to be shown to both he and his house by David after God had established him as king and cut off all his enemies. You know that that's the foundation stone of the friendship between these two. The foundation stone is that Jonathan consistently acknowledged David's superior right to the throne. That was the foundation stone of the covenant of friendship that these two enjoyed. You know, we actually do this every Sunday, don't we? Every Sunday, we come as the disciples, the Jonathan class, and we come before the David, the beloved. And each Sunday memorial meeting, we come to renew and to re-pledge the terms of our covenant of friendship. To restate our pledge of affection and allegiance. And to vow afresh that nothing will come between us and our friendship with him. To declare, like Jonathan, our conviction that one day the Lord will be king. And that soon Yahweh will make all his enemies to be his footstool. And to plead that the Lord will show us the loving kindness of Yahweh when he does ascend his throne. Isn't that what we do? That's the very spirit of Jonathan, isn't it? And we make our covenant anew, Sunday by Sunday, with the man in whom we have covenant friendship. Verse 17, and Jonathan caused David to swear again because he loved him. The Septuagint actually translates it in a different way. It says, and again, Jonathan swear to David. So the authorized version says, Jonathan caused David to swear, but the Septuagint says, and again, Jonathan swear unto David. And then comes back to the margin, by his love towards him. And I think the Septuagint is probably the more realistic of the text, because, you see, the whole context of this passage is that Jonathan is seeking to reassure David of his feelings towards him. That's the context of this passage. Jonathan is seeking to reassure David of his feelings. And so the Septuagint says, and again, Jonathan swear unto David. And what did he swear by? By his love towards him. For he loved him as he loved his own son. The marvellous spirit in that verse, isn't there? You know, that's one of the characteristics of Jonathan. We've seen that phrase used before. But when we put all these phrases together, we have a certain spirit in Jonathan that is characteristic of the way he goes about his business. Now let's just have a look at that spirit in these verses. Look at Jonathan here. 1 Samuel 18, verse 1. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. Again in chapter 18, verse 1. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Chapter 19, verse 2. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted exceedingly in David. Chapter 20, verse 17 here. Jonathan sware unto David by his love towards him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Verse 41 of this chapter. And they each one kissed his friend, and they each wept on his friend. And finally, the David's own comments in the 2 Samuel chapter 1 and verse 26, when he says concerning Jonathan, thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of woman. You know what this is all about, brothers and sisters, concerning the spirit of Jonathan? It's one of the principles of true friendship. And one of the principles of true friendship is fervency of feeling. It says in Proverbs 17, verse 17, a friend loveth at all times. And from the very beginning, Jonathan had locked himself in a consuming eagerness to further David's cause and David's well-being. And isn't that what those verses tell us? Jonathan was prepared to, as it were, strip himself of everything that he owned. Jonathan was prepared to put himself into the background. Jonathan was prepared to lose everything that could have belonged to him because he loved that boy with great fervency of heart. And the strong feelings that Jonathan had towards David is surely the blueprint of how we should feel about Christ and about the truth. The truth is all about the spirit of fervency, isn't it? You know, we live in a time where we're warned in the New Testament that the love of many shall wax cold. And one of the things that we've got to try and rekindle in ecclesial life is the spirit of fervency. It can be seen in all sorts of different ways. Part of the secret of friendship in ecclesial life is learning to do it fervently. Singing hymns. You know, hand in pocket, looking around the room. Oh, Sister So-and-so's got a new hat on today. Some people sing hymns, and the way they sing them, you really think that they really had no interest in the truth whatsoever. In fact, some people don't sing them at all. They just look at them. Singing is an act of worship to God. Can't we do it fervently? Concentration and prayer. Are we really focused? Do we really listen to the brother? Are we able to say at the end, Amen and Amen, because we've heard everything that prayer has said, and we absolutely endorse what the brother has said? Or do we get to the end and say, Oh, what did he say? Because we really haven't listened. Because we're not fervent in our concentration on matters of prayer. What about attendance? Attendance at the classes, at the activities of ecclesial life. You see, we show our fervency by what we do, not what we say. We can say we're fervent, but if we're absent from Bible class, absent from the lecture, rarely attend business meetings, and never go to Bible schools, we're not fervent. Irrespective of whatever comes out of our mouth. And there's always people that somehow in the truth have got every reason under the sun why they can't really support the things of the truth. There's no fervency. What about taking notes? Especially for young people. Taking notes. Very, very valuable skill. Because we want to grow in our knowledge. Not simply to fill our head with knowledge, but so that we can walk before the Father acceptably. What about taking notes? You know, a generation ago, when I say a generation ago, when I was younger, we used to fill reams of paper with notes. Today, sometimes young people find it awfully difficult to even get their Bible open, let alone take notes. That would be asking too much. The truth, brothers and sisters, is all about striving for the best. The truth is all about excellency. The truth is all about zeal. The truth is all about whole burnt offerings to the Father. The truth is all about fervency. That's what makes it special. That's what Jonathan was like. That's the way he went about things. It's a very valuable lesson to learn. It's the secret of, if you want to have wonderful and lasting and stimulating friendships in life, then learn the secret of fervency from the life of this man Jonathan. Verse 18. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and thou shalt be missed, because thy seat will be empty." By the way, that means if it was the new moon that it would be dark. And that would therefore be a good time for David to travel undetected down to Bethlehem, to his family house, in order to keep the family sacrifice there. And so his seat would be missed, because he would be empty. And so verse 19 says, "And when thou hast stayed 3 days, then thou shalt go down quickly." Now the word "stayed" there is not in the Hebrew. It implies that he was going to stay in the place for 3 days. But the literal Hebrew reads, "And the third you shall quickly come down." The word "stayed" is not there in the text. I don't believe David did stay. I think he went to Bethlehem under the dark of the new moon. He came back within the space of the 3 days. And verse 19 says, or Jonathan says, "Thou shalt go down quickly and come to the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand, and shall remain by the stone easel." Now we're not told specifically where the place was, it simply says the place. But we know from verse 24 that it was actually a field. David hid himself in the field. And the place of verse 19 is described as the place where thou didst hide thyself when the business was in hand. What business do you think that was? I think it was the business of chapter 19. You remember in chapter 19 and verse 3, verse 2, take heed to thyself unto the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide thyself, and I will go out and stand beside my father in the field. I think it was in the same place where Jonathan had pleaded with Saul his father in chapter 19. You go back to that. Now that was a very tactful thing for Jonathan to say, wasn't it? So you see, what Jonathan says is, he says, you go back and hide in that place where we were successful before. You go back to that spot. The place where thou didst hide when the business was at hand. You wait there. We had success there before. Let's try again, though. That was an encouraging thing, wasn't it? And verse 20 he says, I will shoot 3 arrows on the side thereof, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send a lad, saying, go, find out the arrows. If I expressly say unto thee, unto the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side of thee, take them. For there is peace to thee and no hurt, and as Yahweh liveth. But if I say unto the young man, behold, the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for Yahweh hath sent thee away. You know, that one of the interesting things about this particular story is Jonathan's very extensive use of the divine name. Have you noticed that? Verse 12. O Yahweh, God of Israel. Verse 13. Yahweh do so, and much more to Jonathan. End of verse 13. And Yahweh be with thee. Verse 14. Show me the kindness of Yahweh. Verse 15. When Yahweh hath cut off the enemies of David. Verse 16. Let Yahweh even require it at the hand of David's enemies. Verse 21. There is no hurt to thee as Yahweh liveth. Verse 22. Go thy way, Yahweh hath sent thee away. Verse 23. And Yahweh be between thee and me forever. So you see, Jonathan openly confesses his own conviction that it is God's guiding hand in the whole matter. He constantly refers to God all the way through. Everything he says, it's all attributed to God. You see what he does say in verse 22 when he says to David, go thy way. He says, for Yahweh hath sent thee away. Not Saul hath sent thee away. Not Jonathan hath sent thee away. Not circumstances have sent thee away. Yahweh hath sent thee away. You know, that's often very hard to appreciate in the darkest of times of trial, isn't it? That God's hand really is still at work in our lives. Jonathan believed that. That's what he's saying, I believe, to David. He said, look, David, whatever you might think, I know that this might seem dangerous, and I know that this might seem difficult, but you've got to believe, David, that God's hand is in the matter. And I believe that, says Jonathan. God will be with you. Verse 23, and as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, Yahweh be between me and thee forever. As touching the matter, the word matter means the word. As touching the word between me and thee. And the word was the word of friendship they had given to each other. As touching that word. They were men of their word. Nothing would break their covenant friendship. And so he says at the end of verse 23, and Yahweh be between me and thee forever. Forever. And so Jonathan now expresses his confidence in God's ability to bring them not just out of this particular problem, but to bring them finally into the kingdom itself, beyond their own day. Yahweh be between us forever. So he takes Jonathan's mind, he says, don't just think about today, David. Sorry. Jonathan takes David's mind, he says, think about tomorrow. He says, I believe God can take us into the very kingdom itself. Focus on that, David. Lift your mind. Be positive. Yahweh be between me and thee forever. Now, just see that moment, can you? The young man who's really finding this very, very hard, who lacks confidence because he is still only young. And Jonathan, the mature man. Jonathan, the one who's really got to sort this problem out. Jonathan, the one who's got to encourage David, to buoy him up, to set him on the right path. Jonathan, who's going to be very much the comforter in this particular story. Yahweh be between me and thee forever. Jonathan's entire speech, you know, had been designed to comfort David. The whole of Jonathan's speech on this particular episode had been designed to comfort David. so that he was going to be Jonathan, the comforter. You know, we need to learn something about comfort. The principle of friendship. Friends comfort one another. You know, we need to understand that true comfort is not commiseration. You know what happens? Someone's got a problem in the meeting. And well, someone comes up to them and says, "Oh, look, I feel so sorry for you. Oh, that is just so shocking. You must feel so terrible. That's a dreadful thing, isn't it, to have happened?" That's not comfort. That's commiseration. Friends don't do that. You know what comfort is? You know what true Bible comfort is? True Bible comfort involves learning to see the problem from the other person's perspective and then offering proper help. That's Bible comfort. And you see, what Jonathan did here was he went through all the things that he knew David was. He tried to see this matter through David's eyes. That's the first step. True friends try and think how their friends will feel. And then having seen the problems that they think their friend is feeling, they then try and think about what the real answers are to those problems, because their friend might not be able to see it. Here's the things I think that Jonathan was thinking about for David's sake on this occasion. I think the first thing was, he says, "I know that he's worried about what my father's attitude is towards him. So we've got to sort that out. I know he's worried about what my father thinks about him. So we've got to get that solved." And the second thing is, "I know that he's really worried about whether he really is ever going to be king. I know that David's concerned about whether the promise of kingship is ever really going to happen, because his life right now looks as if it's all over the place. And the next thing is that David's probably worried about how I feel about him. Especially if we're going to separate, he's probably got concerns about whether I do really still have a friendship for him. So I've got to sort that out. And the next thing is that David, I know, will be worried about what practical arrangements are needed to resolve this problem. What are we actually going to do? What's the actual answer? So I've got to sort that out. And I also think that he needs to be reminded of God's providential care in these matters, because I think that David's forgotten about God's hand. He's only a young man, and young people forget about the divine hand in life when problems come their way. And the last thing is, I think that David somehow needs to have his spirits lifted up to see beyond just the present to the future. But with all those things, that's what Jonathan did. He enacted the role of comforter to a distraught and fearful David, doing all he could to calm his friends and buoy up his spirits to face the future. So in verses 12 to 13, he guaranteed to reveal his father's attitude to David, whether it was good or evil. In verses 14 and 15, he spoke with conviction and certainty that David would be king. In verses 16 and 17, he restated his own vows of affection and his abiding love for David to encourage him. In verses 18 to 20, he made practical arrangements as to how they were going to communicate. In verses 21 and 22, he reminds David of the providential care of Yahweh in all the trials of life. And finally, in verse 23, he lifts David's mind to think about the final joy of the age to come. That's true Bible comfort. Seeing the problem from your friend's perspective and then offering helpful and scriptural advice. You know, brothers and sisters, we all need comforters. We all need friends that could comfort us in time of trouble. You know what the lament of Messiah was in Psalm 69? "I looked for comforters, and there were none," says Christ in Psalm 69, verse 10. And we all need friends in life that can comfort us in times of trouble and of trouble. You know, when you go to David's Psalms later on as a grown man, surely one of the finest spirits of David's Psalms is his ability to see beyond life's trials to the joy of tomorrow. Isn't that one of the themes of David's Psalms? Over and over again. "Whatever life trials are today, I will trust in Yahweh. He will restore. I will have joy in the age." David's always talking about the joy of tomorrow to overcome the trials of today. Where did he learn that spirit from? He got that from Jonathan, didn't he? So what's the lesson of today? Jonathan, the comforter. Repeated pledges, and quiet consolation. The disciples of Christ are committed to fulfilling the desire of his soul. Our relationships in the truth should always be devoid of jealousy or envy, and our plans should always invoke Yahweh's guidance in the matter. Yahweh, Elohim of Israel, be witness. We've learnt that honour is a divine precept which should permeate all aspects of our relationships with others. Jonathan wonderfully upheld this principle in the dignity and reverence he always accorded his father. Each week the disciples come to renew their covenant and to restate their vows of affection. Friendship at its highest is characterized by warmth and by fervency, and by the helpful encouragement that is the basis of godly comfort. Such are the lessons from the life of this wonderful man who encouraged his young friend as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, he says, Yahweh be between me and thee forever. Thank you.